Scott, welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Show Dublin edition.
Yes, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here spontaneously.
Yes, you are a man who doesn't like to schedule things, I hear. So we thought we'd do a spontaneous podcast here. And also we decided to do this like 5 minutes ago. So
here we are.
Yeah. It's about catching the moment, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, we first met in Canada, I believe. Or did we meet before that?
Yeah, we met in Sydney.
Sydney. Oh, yeah. Sydney. Yeah. And you've written two books so far. The one you had last year was The Tao of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
This one. And now your magnum opus, The Age of Time.
Yes. Yeah.
So tell us a little about yourself and then about the book, please.
Yes, I am a longtime fan. I actually started my Bitcoin journey reading some of your books. And part of the reason why I started writing books was because of, how much I personally benefited from reading what other people take the time to write. And so I really believe in, for people who enjoy reading or listening to books, I think it's an important contribution. And so I was Bitcoin class of 2020. And like a lot of people, I spent the first sort of 2 weeks of lockdown in Canada drinking. And then I wanted to get serious about using the time effectively. And I started studying economics. And I was actually referred a Bitcoin book accidentally by Amazon after I had read a bunch of Mises and Rothbard. And that was how this all sort of started for me.
What books was that?
The book that actually flipped it for me was Jeff Booth's Prices Tomorrow. Yeah, which is interesting because, as you know, it's not really explicitly a Bitcoin book at all. And it's not marketed as a Bitcoin book. So I had, it's this book about technology and deflation. And
yeah, I believe he wrote it without knowing about Bitcoin, like the first. He discovered Bitcoin as he was writing the book, if I remember correctly.
Interesting.
And then it all fell into place when he wrote the last few chapters. I might be getting this completely wrong, and sorry, Jeff, if that's the case, but I believe that was the thing, that he wasn't totally orange-pilled until he wrote the book and it finally clicked everything for him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I finished it and then immediately read it again. And then I started reading every Bitcoin book I could get my fingers on. So I spent the next few months. And so since then, I've written a few books. I co-founded a Bitcoin company in Canada called Block Rewards. We build Bitcoin software for paying people in Bitcoin. And so that's sort of what I do when I'm not doing this and writing. And, I think the Bitcoin is just, I love film. And I was talking about this at breakfast this morning. There's a scene in the movie, The Shawshank Redemption, where the warden pushes his finger through a poster and realizes that behind the hole in the poster is the giant hole that Andy had crawled through to his freedom. And I feel like, this is kind of a way to think about Bitcoin, right? It's like, it's just so much bigger. And it's, nobody understands Bitcoin. It's so fascinating to think about. And
it's so funny that you should mention The Shawshank Redemption, because I added three chapters to the Praxeology book. I rewrote that whole thing, so it reads more like a textbook now. And one of the chapters I added is called, what's the chapter called? I can't even remember what it's called, but it's about the Shawshank Redemption. I use that as a metaphor, and that the chapter is called What About the Roads? So it's about debunking this, the notion that the state is absolutely necessary. It's necessary to have a monopoly on violence because the whole, the framing is that what about the roads is not really a question. It's an admittance that you think that roads couldn't happen without coercion. Which is, to me, obviously false. Like, of course, humans built roads before taxation happened. And the analogy in the book is about that. No matter, and it's sort of what the Shawshank Redemption is about. That there's this 90-year-old inmate that gets released and then hangs himself after 2 weeks because he's been totally institutionalized at Shawshank. So he's used to getting his three free meals per day and used to the times of the prison and everything, and he doesn't know what to do when the life outside the prison is a life of complete anxiety at all points, because and that's why Reg, the Morgan Freeman's character, warns Andy Dufresne, the protagonist, about having hope, because he says hope is a dangerous thing because it will kill you when they, if they eventually release you. So you might as well just get used to this and die in here. And Andy refuses to do this. He clings on to hope because hope is the last thing that should, you should never lose hope. It's sort of the message of the whole film. And it's also about time preference and him digging that hole with a teaspoon every day for 10 years and then finally escaping. So no matter what Shawshanky walls the government puts up around you, you can always, if you think they're real, and if you do as they say, and if you would take all of this for as laws of nature instead of man-made bullshit, then you lose all hope, and that's how they win. So the message is hope is a rational choice. You're going to die anyway, so you might as well live with hope.
It's also a really like interesting discussion of the visible and in the invisible prison.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And yeah, but this book is specifically about time. I know that the Gigi's wonderful article, Bitcoin is Time, inspired this a bit. It's inspired a lot of my writing too. So what's the main premise of the book, and what is it about, and what's the message you want to give to people?
And Gigi's Bitcoin is Time piece, to go back to my earlier story, as I was reading things about Bitcoin, Bitcoin is Time was the first thing that I really read that expanded my awareness of the Bitcoin conversation beyond monetary use case. And it was just so cool. Like because I think why that was sort of an important moment for me was it really changed my perception of around what Bitcoin is, and starting to see how people are thinking about it and talking about it. It moved it from, for me, it moved my own personal Overton window from this digital magic money thing to a much larger idea. And so the time thing has always fascinated me since. And DAO of Bitcoin is actually also a lot about time. So when I was really starting to understand Bitcoin, I was observing in myself what I call in the book sort of a changing relationship with the present moment, which I think that Bitcoiners, identify with the language of time preference. And so as you are starting to change your discretionary spending, your Taoism is about an internal, inward experience that manifests outward. As you change the way you think about things, your experience of reality changes. And Bitcoin kind of does this too. So, very early on, as I was really thinking about Bitcoin a lot, I think this happens to people when they get orange pilled, and now all of a sudden you're talking to your wife about it, you're talking to your dog about it. It's like, I was just experiencing a change in my experience of time. And so the books are, in some ways the same or along similar lines, because the time thing has, for me, is more interesting than the conversation about money. I think that, so what is Age of Time about? The acknowledgement in the first book is kind of this idea that as Bitcoin is transforming your reality, it's changing how you interact with time. Age of Time is more of an attempt to think about what exactly that phenomenon is and how it works. And so I feel firstly that the problem of money is much more obvious than the problem of time. And for this reason, the monetary use case of Bitcoin is sexier, but it's also just, it's a lot easier to understand. We use money. There are many forms of money, and Bitcoin offers us a very easy way to do an A/B test on the properties of money. And so, it's something that people can really we can find common ground on very easily. Whereas with time, there really isn't, no one's really thinking about Bitcoin yet, I think, as a mirror to examine whether or not how we think about time is the smartest way to do it, or whether there's actually even a problem with time itself. We have been thinking about time for ages, and you know, all the way back, early cultures, Plato was writing about time. And so in the book, I sort of trace the history of time in the same way that, you know, Saifedean traces the history of money in the Bitcoin Standard. And going back sort of 400 years, we had the invention of the pendulum, which created the mechanical clock, standardization of time, 1657. And so I sort of think that 1657 is the 1971 of time. And what makes this a sort of wild rabbit hole to start there is 400 years is actually long enough that now no one has been, you know, we've all been adopted into this time system, and it's been running long enough that it has really drifted into the realm of the unquestioned. Like, we're not really examining the notion of time because we have, over the last 400 years, built our entire civilization on top of it. Time is really upstream of money. And what we've done since the invention of the pendulum is reduce the idea to its most base form so that we can really agree about it without even having to consider it. Because there are all kinds of, you know, going back thousands of years, there are all kinds of ideas about time. Is time a fundamental force flowing through the universe? Is it something that we observe as part of consciousness? Is it both? But what clocks really do is turn that complex idea into 12 numbers and two hands so that we can all easily look at something and not have to really think about it. So what I, you know, when in the white paper, Satoshi was trying to solve a problem of ordering an agreement. And in Age of Time, you know, I think that firstly, he's talking about a coordination problem. How do we scale this solution of, you know, a decentralized money on a, online? And mechanical clocks, to me, timekeeping is a coordination problem.
And that's a very literal coordination problem if you just move a bit out into space. When they send astronauts up, they come back and they're a little older than everyone else, or a little younger. I can't remember which one it is. But like, so space and time are really two sides of the same coin. Yeah. And gravity is just curvature in space-time. And so our perception of time is very specific to what's going on the Earth and not to what it actually is, I guess.
Yeah. And so, like, so what we've done by scaling mechanical time is really invented a system that operates without respect to any of those things. And you know, one minute is 1 minute anywhere on Earth. And so it almost loses some of the richness or the texture of the description in the system that we built. And I think that, there's an argument to be made that civilization adopts the logic of the dominant form of timekeeping. And we can see the results of that change in things like architectural trends and the way we imagine how we use time. Because there was a time before mechanical clocks. There was a long period of time. Most of human history existed before mechanical clocks. And we collectively inhabited time as a civilization in a much different way during that period.
But the calendar is super old. So maybe not the mechanical clock, but calendars have been around for like 6,000 years or something.
Totally. Yeah. 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 So what is changing there, the innovation, is the discretization of time into smaller and smaller measurable units, right? So what happened in 1657 really was the ability to distribute minutes. And we started to see clock towers becoming the central point of coordination in city-states in Europe, where now all of a sudden everything revolves around a single clock. Markets open, we just start to adapt our behavior. So that process started hundreds of years ago. And then we get into, like the internet, subsequent innovations, like time zones, train schedules, the JIT economy.
Daylight saving both.
Right. Yeah. Everything starts to be layered on top. And this is, so this is how 400 years later, no one's really examining time, because so many things are built on top of it that there isn't really a great opportunity to go backwards now and say, are we doing this right? But the problem is that it doesn't stop at minutes. You know, we've gotten to seconds and atomic clocks. Yeah. Like we're measuring this thing into oblivion. And alongside that is the human experience of time, and which has appreciably declined as technology has, you know, I think there's a really important narrative around accelerationism here, because what I think is a more pressing problem than the erosion of currency, time is way more precious and finite than money. And we are now seeing also an exponential meting out of the time that we have. And we notice that through how we distribute our free time, right? So we used to watch whole films, Netflix, Instagram reels, TikTok is like seconds. And so we're training our attention spans in parallel to this like time phenomenon. And I think it has to do with the face of a clock actually doesn't reference anything. It just endlessly wheels in a circle. And it creates a sort of like a mindset, a collective agreement around sort of like endless forward progress. I think that that was not present in the previous cultures. And we can see that based on how they thought about building structures. Like, so Europe is covered in buildings that took centuries to build. And if I was to start a company today that said, we're going to start a building, I'm going to hope to have it done by 2400. Does everyone think this is cool? I like everyone to think I'm insane.
So, there's so much to unpack here. First, I think that one of the reasons that the Gregorian calendar and time as we measure it now is so popular is because it's so super accurate. I think that's, if I remember correctly, like when the year 2000 was supposed to be a leap year, but then again, it was supposed to be not a leap year, because every 400 years, the leap year is left out. It's called a leap year. Is that correct term? Yeah. So, and except every 2000 years. So this was the first exception to the exception. So it was actually leap year in the 2000s. And that makes the calendar accurate to like the minute on a time scale of 100,000 years or something like that. And then there's something called a leap second, like every 13 years or something, there's a leap second. And it's extremely accurate and has been for a very, very long time. And there's also another fascinating thing, that if we had 13 months per year instead of 12, every month would be 28 days.
And every so, and every day would start, I think, on a Monday. Yeah. So there's actually, I think, a fair amount of debate around the Gregorian calendar as an example of when the problem with the centralization of authority, timekeeping is one of those things, and history and record keeping is another, because the 13-month calendar in a lot of ways makes much more sense. And yeah, there are a number of sort of fringe schools of history that think a lot of recorded history has been edited or falsified, and the calendar, the years are part of that, because There's a sound argument that at least 300 years of European history from like 600 to 900 was completely made up, so that certain people could be said to have been ruling at the 1000, at the turn of 1000, and the calendars themselves are a funny thing. You know, the week, the modern concept of the week does go back a really long way. There's nothing in nature that identifies one day from the next day. So we completely made up the notion of a 7-day week. It could be, weeks could be 3 days, weeks could be 10 days. And
this is before the Bible, right? So, yeah. So 7 days per week has been along also since like forever, right?
Yeah. Seven comes from, there were at the time, seven astral bodies that didn't conform. So all of the stars rotate around Polaris, the North Star. except for the five visible planets and the sun and the moon. So the seven, they were called wandering stars. The seven wandering stars became a day for each of them. So Monday is Moon Day, Sunday is Saturday is for Saturn. And Saturn is the outermost visible planet, the boundary of the cosmos. And so it became the boundary of the week. It's the last day of the week cycle.
Welcome to the spooky nighttime edition of the Ad Reads. You should check out the Bitcoin Advisor. They're very good for inheritance planning and have a multi-sig setup that is super cool. Bitcoinadvisor.com. You should also check out the Bitbox. It's a great hardware wallet. The Nano 2 is their latest edition. It's super cool, and they're privacy-focused and very neat to use. Bitbox.swiss is their web address. And Bull Bitcoin, of course. Bull Bitcoin has a cool exchange, a super-based exchange that does the least amount of KYC that is allowed anywhere. They're now in Europe as well, and the Bull Bitcoin wallet is super cool. Check it out. Use code INFINITY everywhere, and you get a big discount. Boo! Also, check out BitcoinInfinity.com. That's where you find all my books and Luke's book for Bitcoin and a bunch of other books and t-shirts and stuff. It's a really cool website. We made it ourselves. Wow.
Yeah. So would you agree that time is money? Like, yeah. What's the connection? I mean, I have my definition of the – maybe I should lay it out. Like, because my understanding of it is that in lowering your time preference, that's really equivalent to accumulating capital. The most basic example being Robinson Crusoe trying to catch fish with his hands. And if he, instead of doing that, he sets aside some fish to feed himself while constructing a fishing net – he lowers his time preference and delays his gratification. And when the fishing net is done, he can catch more fish per time unit, thereby increasing his productivity. So civilization is very much tied to people lowering their time preference and saving up capital for the future. So capital is really stored up time. And capitalism, the word in itself, in its very basic meaning of it, is just better resource allocation over time, or like saving up time. That's what it's all about. And I think that this is only partially true until we discover Bitcoin, because now we have something that is a perfect representation of the finiteness of every human being's lifetime. So sats are as scarce or even more scarce than your minutes on this planet. What are your thoughts around that? There's a link there for sure.
Yeah. And so this is where, you know, I also think the idea of the problem of time being upstream of money, because there were interest-bearing loans before mechanical clocks, but the modern interest-bearing loan came after. And Edward Chancellor wrote a book, he's a financial historian, wrote a book in the last year called The Price of Time, which is a really great history of interest and how we evolved that concept. I think that, you know, why this matters for civilization is, you know, the time problem as it's currently constructed forces a never-ending compression on the time horizon of decision making, which is a bad thing when we are trying to, like, yeah, civilization.
Yeah, that's not a lowering of time preference, but the opposite. Like, it's a higher and higher time preference.
Yeah, and so what do I, you know, to come back to your question about? I think that when I was talking earlier about the idea that the clock is this really base reduction of an idea so that everybody can understand it, Bitcoin as a clock is the reverse. And as a system for describing reality, it actually offers a completely new way of describing a set of information. And what it's doing by it is it's unifying value and time into a single expression. And it does that because blocks have an associated and fixed number, the block reward, attached to that unit of time. So in the current system, clocks can describe seconds and minutes and hours. And then independent of that, we have 180 different currencies that we're all trying to use and compare to each other, and then we smush those together to price time. Yeah, so it's almost like thinking about describing the size of this table by either having the length and the width of it, or by having the area. So to me, Bitcoin transforms that information into a single expression by sort of bonding the relationship between energy and time, value and time, sorry, with energy in a permanent and predictable way. So this is how it becomes really a civilization level technology for changing the way we think about value and time, no longer as being separate things and being sort of one unified expression.
So could you say that all fiat currencies are really broken clocks?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And so this is where I think like it's such an interesting thing, because we spend so much time talking about broken money. And I don't even know that you can properly capture the problem without incorporating a clock into it and talking about how important time, because, you know, when we think about an expenditure or planning, we always think about how long it's going to take. And this is partly the reason why we don't build buildings that take 300 years anymore. The price of lumber went up like 700% the last 20 years. So you can't even think in 20 years to build a building. And, you know, I have a chapter in my book that's titled "Beauty is a Symptom of a Thriving Civilization." You know, and we really, I feel, part of what is inspiring about Bitcoin is thinking about all these cool changes that could result if we had mass adopted as a monetary technology. And I think we could experience even cooler changes if we were to adopt it as a time technology. Because another really amazing thing that Bitcoin offers is, so, you know, I think that the human mind, it takes a certain amount of time for us to ingest an idea. The human mind needs time to think. And this is actually what is sort of under constant attack in the notification society that we have found ourselves in. And if you want to scale that out into a group, the bigger you scale the group, the more time is required. Consensus takes time. And so the Bitcoin clock has built into it this really incredible mechanism where the fastest we can ever agree on something is around 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is actually, I think, it's critical. It's really important, because it's almost creating a safeguard for us around the never-ending acceleration of the expectation for us to be able to think at a certain speed. And this is becoming more important as AI can produce content at rates that we can't even begin to digest. And so, you know, you scale this out to all of civilization, and Bitcoin offers, like a respite. It gives us some room to breathe. Yeah. And then we can think again and start thinking about planning things on appropriate time horizons.
And this is the beauty of the difficulty adjustment algorithm. I think Gigi goes into this, like how the 10 minutes decides the 2 weeks or the 2016 blocks, because it adjusts according to if it actually took 10 minutes or not. And then the 2 weeks decide the 10 minutes, what that means. So it's like circular, and it's just a thing of beauty, if you properly understand. I am yet to encounter a person who is like against Bitcoin that understands the difficulty adjustment algorithm. It simply, such a person does not exist.
Yeah, I mean, you could blow that idea all the way out to, in the book I talk about, it's a causal loop between 2009 and 2140. The exact same mechanism you just described is actually operating on over a century long scale. It's breathing. And I mean, that's incredible. Like if you think about, so the last block, you know, you were talking earlier about, yeah, the time cones as it's being pushed to the present moment. This future moment in 2140, the last block, it exists right now, because it has to, because the first block and the mechanism that connects those two moments, and we're somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, and that's just mind blowing to think about this stuff. So, one interesting question. I had a very good guest, my good friend Volker, talking about free will and how it's it either cannot exist or presupposes a soul or something supernatural going on, or what I suspect could be like quantum entanglement in back in time or something like that. It's just very hard to grasp. But the idea is the synapse in your brain will have to precede the decision made by your brain. So that would allude to free will, not that free will couldn't exist, because the electrons would have to fire off before the decision is made. And you can actually measure the consciousness comes with a delay. So we're what we think are our own rational decisions is really our consciousness playing up whatever our brain did for us. So some part of our brain made the decision. And it doesn't really matter to praxeology. I mean, we do see, but we do decide on what means to use to reach certain ends. That process happens anyway, regardless of whether free will exists or not. It's the framework is still correct. But it's fascinating to think about, because it's such an outlandish thought that we couldn't have free will. And I like the Christopher Hitchens quote, of course we have free will, we have no choice but to have it. But it's such a fascinating paradox. Does the book go into that at all?
Yeah, a little bit. I was recommended, there are a few books that really inspired the idea together. And one of the last ones that I read that kind of finished the concept of the book for me is a book called The User Illusion, by a Danish author, Tor Nordtanders. And it's a really, really great read. User Illusion is
Guns N' Roses album.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's true. I wonder which came first. I think they're about the same age. So in User Illusion, one of the core arguments around the idea is that actually the sensory information from the different senses in your body arrives to the brain with a different latency. Yeah. So sight is the first signal that your brain takes in, touch, smell, they don't stream in simultaneously.
No, your toes, if you get hit on the toe, that takes longer than for you to get hit on the head.
Yeah. So it's, in addition to what you were describing, your brain actually delivers to you, we think we're experiencing life in real time. But our brain is delivering a composite of all of that information on a slight tape delay.
Yeah, so we're like half a second faster.
Yeah, otherwise it would be like watching a badly dubbed movie. Everything would be completely insane.
I hope the YouTube video won't be out of sync here. It would be a good illustration of what's actually going on.
So that's a really powerful idea, because that on its own eliminates the idea that we're all operating in real time. We are not experiencing reality in the way that we think we are. And I think that, and so part B of that is that it's also true that the brain is performing all kinds of procedures for us to help us make sense of this experience, unconscious things that just happen. So I think of it a little bit like the brain is like a blockchain. Because this is how Bitcoin works, right? And I think it's probably not uncoincidental that that's how Bitcoin works. It's a mirror of consciousness. And so what's happening there is that there is a certain amount of uncertainty as information is organized, and your brain is taking in all these different things, sort of pruning them, deciding what version of it you're going to get. And then once you get that, it's permanent and it happened.
Yeah, yeah. And you filter the spam out.
Yes. Yeah. You have the longest chain. And so I wonder about how much of that process is invisible to us, beyond the half a second delay. And to your question about time, I think it's very possible that the experience that we experience of linear time is simply a result of the ordering mechanism that exists inside the brain.
Would this explain why, you experience time differently at different ages?
Yeah, totally. And things like deja vu or intuition, this could be more thought of as like an unconfirmed block in the mempool. It's possible that it's kind of like pre-membering. We haven't sorted that data out yet, but coming back to you know, physics and time, there's actually a lot of debate and unsettlement around, you know, being able to prove what time is as a fundamental force. And so, yeah, whether or not these things are interdependent of each other is also, you know, difficult to prove or know.
I mean, this is so fascinating because it reminds me of a theory I once read about, which is kind of out there, called like the mimetic theory of reality or something like that. And the premise is that the objective reality is where our subjective interpretations of it collide. So that's why both you and I perceive this to be a table, for instance, instead of just fluctuations in the wave function of the whatever Higgs boson field. Like, I don't know the correct terms, but, and also that it sort of aligns with that idea of the mempool. In Bitcoin, there's no such thing as the mempool. We all have different mempools, but we finally decide on the what actually ends up in the block. That's what manifests in reality, and consciousness creating reality around us. Like the saying is, we don't experience the reality the way it is. We objective reality the way it is. We experience it the way we are. So and this could, yeah, this sort of maps onto that.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that coming back to this idea of Bitcoin as a civilizational clock, there's a really big idea here around what we've done as the result of centralizing time. And I don't think we really think about time as being centralized in the same way we think about it as money as being centralized. But like most people actually get told what time it is today by either Apple or Samsung. You know, time is incredibly standardized or centralized. And it's become so unquestioned. It's like just something that runs in the background. And I think that in some ways, because civilization really is the most immense coordination project that we have, and it rests on sort of a lattice of unquestioned beliefs, right? Like, we just don't have the bandwidth to be continually evaluating everything. So we come to an agreement on something makes sense. Okay, now that's good. Let's go on to solving some other problem. But again, like, there was a civilization that existed in a different period of time. And people, so we were building great things before mechanical clocks, pyramids, megaliths, and this was before centralized time enabled shared time to be scaled beyond a physical geography. And I'd say this is why the great things that happened before mechanical clocks really happened in one shared space. You know, this is why you have like Giza. We could accomplish incredible things, but it was where everyone was sort of in one locality. And that's progressed through to the current age. But the transition proves that a transition is possible. So it's like, if you believe as a Bitcoiner that it's possible for us to adopt an entirely new agreement about what we think money is and how money should work, it should also be possible that time is on the table and that we could adopt, again, a new way of thinking about how we agree at scale around the order that things happen. And if we do that in this new way that not only incorporates how much time it took, but what it was worth, that's like a really, it's like a step function improvement in the sophistication of how we're thinking about the information we use to describe our reality.
So would you be a proponent of changing the calendar to before and after Satoshi, calling everything before Satoshi BS?
Yeah.
like stopping this nonsense of thinking that we're living 2026 years after the alleged birth of a carpenter's son in a desert somewhere, and like just start viewing Bitcoin as the true birth of actual distributed timekeeping.
Yeah. Actually, I think it completely makes sense because, you know, there are lots of ideas that the year is made up. And, you know, so I think that the one thing that Bitcoin offers civilization is the basis for the expectation of a rational civilization. You know, like all of our institutions should revolve around this incorruptible thing that can't be co-opted by anyone. Like that should be a non-negotiable starting point for the basis of, you know, kind of what I call like a new golden age. Like if we want to, these things need to be wrested away from the ability to corrupt them to certain people's advantages. And that's, it's not just money, right? And so
we need to come up with another term like golden age, though. It should be like a clockwork orange. Yeah.
And so I think, I hope so. The problem is that, you know, we will still need for coordination purposes, units that are more accurate than blocks. And so I think I suggest that we're going to stop wearing watches. Like it's not, you know, and I always kind of like caution around, I think it's so cool to think about what Bitcoin could become, but in Age of Time specifically, I'm very careful with the kind of pronouncements I make about what Bitcoin might be. I let other people fool around with more experimental ideas and conjecture. It's actually very rooted. It's a very grounded in reality discussion around, you know, this is the thing about mechanical timekeeping is like central banks. It's an innovation that for its time was really important. Well-meaning served a very, you know, like critical stage in the progression of the complexity of civilization. And the trade-off of that centralization has produced some problems that I think could be remedied by a continued investigation about what could be better.
So would you say, like, because you can't really inflate minutes, but as it's sort of like, maybe it's akin more to the gold standards of prices, or it's the illusion of stable prices. Yeah. Is the same as the illusion of stable minutes, I guess, then.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the core issue with having these numbers be related but not fixed to each other. So in the mechanical time fiat world, the units of time are fixed and don't change, but the value is totally arbitrary and changing all the time. And so when they're bonded together in a sensible and permanent way, it just eliminates, basically, like, you know, you need one number to express how much value is some kind of combination of energy and time. And, you know, so if you should be able to think, I think about it like a triangle. And, you know, it's like with an isosceles triangle, if you know the information about two sides, you should be able to figure out the third. So if you know how much time something took and how much it cost to make, you should know what it's worth. And if you know how, you know, like there should be
that sounds Marxist to me, though, like labor theory of values sort of thing, because it doesn't really align with subjective valuations, does it? Like it, just because you put a lot of time and effort into something doesn't mean that I value it and want to buy it off of you.
Yeah, that's true.
So how do you square that?
I think that it's potentially a better solution to this that what we have now, where that what we have to describe value makes so little sense that I see that as a bigger fish to fry, where the economic theory around how that actually works in practice becomes developed by other people who are living in that world. Once that system's been adopted, if that makes, yeah.
I'd say that the way I view it relates to value in a different way. The higher valuations are implicit and sort of inevitable because of the scarcity of the asset and how perfectly it represents the scarcity of human time. So all prices drop forever is the thesis, the everything divided by 21 million thesis, or whatever you may call it, like, but in theory could drop forever, but it will fluctuate forever also.
Yeah. I mean, so I think about it like Bitcoin is a system that is capturing more and more information about all of the activity that's happening in the world. Yeah. And in the everything divided by 21 million thesis, at some point, all of the information about all of the activity would be captured by that system. And so in that system, this idea of the three things together, it has the ability to capture all of the information, and it also has the ability to measure the time. So that, and then in, so in that way, it has the ability to value everything that is being valued is related to the time. So like all of the economic activity in the world for 10 minutes is captured in that, in that, in that discrete measurement. And then as a result, we'll find some way to value everything inside that and properly, like, and related to each other. Because if we back it up one step further to what we're doing now, it is all these separate systems that have nothing to do with each other. Currencies that don't have any, you know, we have to then artificially figure out some kind of way to evaluate them to each other. And in this world, it's more like, you know, if I'm, you know, creating aluminum in Canada and sending it to Argentina to make boats, like, you know, we're operating in some unified system where it's one expression, one number. There's a lot to figure out in between, but that's kind of how I see it evolving.
Did you see a movie called, I think it's called In Time, the Justin Timberlake, is it? This place that, where instead of money, you have a certain amount of seconds left on your life. I think that's a Bitcoin movie without knowing it's a Bitcoin movie.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I can think a lot of the time movies are. It's because for individuals, you know, Bitcoin is a negotiation with your future self. Every time you spend Bitcoin, yeah.
That's why I don't like the term store of value, by the way. I think it's a medium of exchange over time and space. So it's four-dimensional medium of exchange. Yeah. And you're saving or hodling is just trading with your future self.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that that understanding, whether it's conscious or unconscious, is what drives the behavioral change and that subjective change in the experience of time. And I think that that scales to collective consciousness. And we can all experience that. And so Age of Time, really, at the end of it, is a thought experiment around what happens when humanity is actually ingested at different clock. Because our built world, our built environment, has transformed immensely under the programming, the operating system of mechanical time. And so it's, to me, it is rational to expect that we will move forward and design a very different physical environment to inhabit when we have all come to a different agreement around what time is and what it's worth.
Have you explored that as an actual scaling solution for Bitcoin? Because one thing, a thought I've had for a long time is that if we all lower our time preference and if we all get richer over time because of number go up or purchasing power go up, which is more accurate, then we will use money less and less over time. So the future I foresee, like I view microtransactions as a very Keynesian fiat-y thing. So instead of paying a euro every time I go to the bathroom in the central station somewhere in Europe today, I will pay a one-time Bitcoin payment for a lifetime subscription to all the train rides I want in my life, because the receiver of the money is incentivized to get it as soon as possible because purchasing power goes up over time. So I see fewer and fewer transactions happening, and that being a good thing, and that like deflation and the velocity of money being the biggest lie ever told, really.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that and around that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, again, an example of one of those things where it starts in the individual person, and civilization is a collection of individual persons conforming to a shared set of rules. And so as we all do this, it starts to make sense again to think about building something that takes 300 years, you know. And this is what they're doing in China with trying to reforest the Gobi Desert. So there is a massive multi-decade projects. And, you know, I think China is a great one. Thing that they're really doing better than the rest of the world is behaving like a proper country and thinking and things thinking in long
terms of time preference, yes. At least.
Yeah.
Not in all ways.
Not in all ways. No, but in that exact way. They are, you know, and it's, I think, partly because I lived in China 20 years ago, and they are one of the oldest continuous civilizations, and they have a different way of thinking about long duration because of how old their culture is. And so this time consciousness thing is fascinating to me because, you know, how it works in Bitcoin, I think, is, you know, how it works in the individual human mind. And I think it's how it works in civilization.
Yeah. Ironically enough, I have to check the time here because I know that you're about one block away from having to be on stage upstairs. It would be better maybe if they measured, if they put the program in block heights instead of, maybe we're not there yet, but you have to be there in about 9 minutes. So we need to close this out pretty soon. But before we do, like, is there anything here we haven't covered that you'd like to talk about a bit more?
You know, I don't know if there's anything that really that jumps out. If you're interested, and the book is available on Amazon, and I also have a personal website for it, theageoftime.com, and you can if you want to buy the book for Sats, you can. That's where you can do that. Yeah.
And if people want to contact you, will you even respond? Or
like yeah, honestly, very much. And I'm super interested in people feedback on the book. If you read it, I'd love to hear from you. I'm on Twitter and Noster. The handles are the same. It's a Lantern Bitcoin. And the Lantern is I made a short story about that. I talked about it in the book. I'm fascinated by lanterns are one of the oldest human technologies, and it's a technology for transmitting light.
Enlightenment.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, the point of having a lantern is so that you could transport light. And so that's sort of where the idea came from. And it's an important part of the book because, now, I think these throughout the history of civilization are a number of different inventions rooted in hope, and a lantern is one of them.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, we're here at the Bitcoin Ireland conference in Dublin. We're having a great time here. You should come and visit next year. We go to more Bitcoin conferences in general.
Yeah,
and. Yeah, I think that's about it. Thank you very much, Scott. Yeah,
thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Yeah, likewise. This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Show Dublin edition. Brush your teeth and see you next time.